Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit in Toronto by the Groundwire National Coordination Team. I'm your host, Ome Salma Rahimtullah. In this episode...
Today, I stand here to tell you that we will not allow this to continue. We will not allow violence against women.
Well, a couple of days ago, I attended an eviction party. The Quaiyuk membership has had enough.
My message to all community radio station listeners is to be active. Don't take your media outlet for granted, and stay involved mostly in the decision-making process.
But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from Kathy Inouye with Labour Radio at CKUT in Montreal. The new year saw the rise in the minimum wage across the country as a result of the hard work and advocacy of the labour movement in Canada. However, with the raise in the minimum wage, some multinational corporations, such as Tim Hortons, took it as an opportunity to roll back worker benefits and worker rights. Pam Frake organizes with the Fight for 15 campaign in Ontario.
Like cutting back on paid breaks, cutting back on access to basic health and dental benefits, like forcing people to pay for their uniforms, eliminating the one coffee and donut that people are allowed to have when they finish their shift. That has been eliminated.
In response, the Fight for 15 and Fairness campaign called for a national day of action in support of workers at Tim Hortons on January 19th across the country to send a message about decent work and wages.
We want to send a message that it is not business as usual with Tim Hortons so long as they are clawing back those workers' wages. And we simply cannot stop until Tim Hortons makes it right by its employees.
Following headline comes from contributor Michael Welsh from University of Winnipeg-based radio station CKUW 95.9 FM. Several dozen members of the Kurdish-Canadian community gathered outside the Canadian Museum for Human Rights in downtown Winnipeg on the afternoon of Tuesday, January 23rd, to register their disappointment to the recent assault by the Turkish military against the Kurdish-dominated Afrin region in northwest Syria. Some proudly waved the red, yellow, green, and white flags of Kurdistan. Others wore white tunics splashed with red to resemble blood stains. Still others held homemade banners and signs, all while shouting the chant, "Terrorist Erdogan." One of the speakers was Dilshan Ado of the Kurdish Initiative. Her family are residents of Afrin, and she spoke to the group about the carnage being meted out on innocent civilians in the path of the Turkish offensive.
More than 1 million civilians are under Turkish attack. Why? I am here now. There were dozens of people have been killed.
Turkey's offensive, known as Operation Olive Branch, began on January 19th and is ostensibly targeting the Kurdish People's Protection Units known as the YPG. According to Turkish military sources, 260 Islamic State and Kurdish fighters have died as a result of their operations in Afrin. Thanks to community videographer Paul S. Graham for supplying the audio for that headline. Our next headline comes from the National Council of Canadian Muslims, who are petitioning the government to mark January 29th as the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. Canadian Muslim communities are still reeling from the devastating terrorist attacks in Quebec last January that claimed the lives of 6 Muslim men worshipping in their mosque and gravely injured many others. Today, January 29th, marks the first anniversary of the massacre at the Quebec City Mosque, and the National Council of Canadian Muslims, with the support of over 70 Canadian Muslim associations and organizations and over 24 community partners, recently wrote to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau asking his government to designate January 29th as a National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. This call is based on precedent. Every December 6th, there is a National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women to mark the anniversary of the 1989 shooting massacre of 14 women at L'École Polytechnique de Montréal. The federal government says it has received and noted the council's proposal. Stay tuned to the next episode of Groundwire, where we will have special coverage on the actions and vigils taking place across the country in memory of the victims and the fight against Islamophobia. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Source for news from the ground up, available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. You just heard Ice Walker by Iskwe from her album The Fight Within. Now it's time for our feature stories. January 20th marked the second anniversary of the International Women's March, which started last year in opposition to the inauguration of American President Donald Trump. The mission of the Women's March is to harness the political power of diverse women and their communities to create transformative social change. Women's marches were held in cities across the world. We get report backs from the Winnipeg, Manitoba, and Victoria, British Columbia Women's Marches.
Hi, I'm Mahalit Cuff.
I'm Jen Unwin.
And we produce Femisphere on CKUW 95.9 FM. This clip is from the second annual women's rally at City Hall that happened on January 20th.
The rally was attended by a diverse crowd of around 300. Our feature clip is Bernadette Smith, MLA from Point Douglas constituency in downtown Winnipeg.
And I'm going to tell you a little story about how I kind of got involved in this issue. So I'm going to talk about missing and murdered Indigenous women here in Manitoba. So in 2008, my sister went missing. She made some phone calls. She ended up making her last call at Selkirk and King. And at that time, there was not a lot of support in Winnipeg. We went to the police station. We made a report. We were given an instant number, in fact, just right across the street here, and we were sent on our way. Nobody gave us any support. Nobody came to us and said, you can go here and they'll help you. We'll help you make a poster. We'll help you do searches. We'll help you put on a vigil. So we were in shock. We never ever thought that this would happen to our family, as many of our families do. You know, we have over 1,200 sisters missing across this country, many who, you know, have no answers, and families, you know, are still waiting and out there actively searching for their loved ones. So, you know, I just want people to know that often what happens in the media is our loved ones are portrayed as less than human. And that's exactly what happened with my sister. So when she went missing, it was Aboriginal, sex trade, drug addicted woman missing. And it wasn't until you read into the second paragraph that you actually found out who she was. So it was very disheartening, and it actually gave the public, and we went on CBC's where you can make comments, and people were making comments like, well, she put herself in that position. Well, she shouldn't have been using drugs. She shouldn't have been on the street. And, you know, we worked really hard, and I think we still have a lot of work to do. But I think we're at a place where people now understand that, you know, these are diseases, that every woman deserves a right to live, that nobody has the right to take anyone's life.
Fontaine, MLA for St. John's. if 2017 showed us anything, it is the power of women. It is the power of women to reject patriarchy in all of its forms. And being here is part of that movement. It is part of that rejection of patriarchy.
What would you call the number one issue right now for women?
You know what? I think that you could sum it all up in respect of just the inequitable position and context that women find ourselves in here in Manitoba and in Canada, certainly. Violence, housing, education, healthcare, all of those things, they're all wrapped up in the sense that women are not equal. If we were equal, there'd be no need for us to be here today. Okay. There'd be no need for us to be here today.
My name is Ravimbu Chimutsa, and I wanted to come to the march today because I don't believe in being silent. I believe that if you have the opportunity to use your voice, your body, your mind in any way, shape, or form to fight injustice, then you should.
I'm Shandy Strong, and I'm here because I support human rights. Women's rights are human rights, and trans rights are human rights, and there are so many great speakers here today that just actually, you know, drove that home and drove home how intersectional and indivisible those rights are.
So it's January 20th. We're here in downtown Victoria at the City Hall, the Centennial Square there, for the Women's March Canada. This is the anniversary of last year's inaugural march in the United States and across North America. The speechifying is already going on, but see what they have to say.
My name is Lisa Helps, and I am the mayor of this fine city of Victoria. So my first honor is to introduce somebody from the Victoria Immigrant and Refugee Center Society. So joining you this morning is Carrie Greenridge.
We want to include men, youth, and ethnocultural communities in this conversation because often they're left out. And you can't move forward with change if you don't include these parties. But most of all, we also want to include faith-based institutions as well, because the conversation and education of the impact of domestic violence is very important on keeping the family unit healthy. And now I'll pass on to my colleague, Ida, and she's going to share about her experience living here in Canada as an immigrant.
My name is Ida. I have been here for 7 years in Canada, first in Montreal, now in this awesome city. I just want to say it is so inspiring and exciting to see so many people here, not only women, but also men who are ready to listen to us. Myself, I am Latin, but Latins are so diverse as well. We have all colors in our skins. We have all together black, white, indigenous. So I feel like we can embrace all of our ancestry and be aware of our differences, not being colorblind, but rather acknowledge what privileges we carry with us and how can we support others and empower others.
My name is Elizabeth May. I'm a member of Parliament for Saanich Gulf Islands, the leader of the Green Party of Canada. And like Lisa Helps, our mayor, I am not a speaker today. We are recognizing grassroots activists from right across the spectrum. We'll be hearing from Boma Brown and Christine C. Thank them and welcome them.
Hi everybody, my name is Boma and I'm joined here with Christine, Katie, and Kulan. And like Elizabeth said, we are from the Support Network for Indigenous Women and Women of Color. We're an organization that fights for women's access to full reproductive choice. Please join us for the fight to make sure that all women, regardless of race, immigration, and things like that, can fight, can also achieve reproductive justice.
The next speaker is Zainab Bint Yunus. She is a Canadian Muslim woman, a writer, and an activist in the local Muslim community.
Islamophobic hate crime has gone up by 253% since 2012. Yet only 6 in 10 Canadians think that Islamophobia is a problem.
Arab women in our country. Visibly Muslim women are primary targets of both Islamophobia and sexism, often in the same breath. Muslim women are viewed simultaneously as threats and as easy targets, as symbols of a politically created, media-fueled boogeyman, while also passive, posing no fear of retribution or even self-defense. Today, I stand here to tell you that we will not allow this to continue. We will not allow violence against women. Today, we stand together as women and as allies, committed to upholding the right of all women to live in safety, security, and strength. Today, we march forward.
Really a very successful turnout and a spirited march. And now it's off to the legislature.
Thanks to Jen Unwin and Muhalet Kaf from CKUW's Feminist Collective and Chris Cook of Guerrilla Radio at CFUV in Victoria for that feature. Our next feature comes from Gennarji O'Sullivan from Vancouver Co-op Radio with an update and analysis of the First Nations struggle against exploitative fish farming in British Columbia.
Just recently, January 22nd, First Nations leaders hand eviction notice to BC Fish Farm, setting out from Port Hardy on Vancouver Island. Members of at least six BC First Nations took to the sea Monday to deliver an eviction notice to fish farms operated by Marine Harvest, one of Canada's largest producers of farmed Atlantic fish. Their symbolic protest is the latest of Rock BC fish farms industry. Ernest, can you give us an update on what has been happening with the fish farm occupations?
Sure. A couple of days ago, I attended an eviction party. The Kwagyuk membership has had enough. And unfortunately, the Kwagyuk are one of those nations that have signed agreements with Marine Harvest. And so the membership decided to take it upon themselves to evict this corporation from their territories. And we went along because I think it's high time that those that have signed agreements nullify those agreements, and not only that, but pursue evicting them. And so that's what we did a couple of days ago. We went up to near Port Hardy and handed out eviction notices, and I spoke on behalf of our head chief, Yakuglas. The response is always have always been from this corporation, this industry, has been pretty shameful. It's so obvious to us, and it's so obvious to our members, that this industry and these companies have no idea how to deal with First Nations people. It's frustrating to me because we've sat down with this industry. Our people have sat down at the various tables. We have complied completely with just about every one of those demands. But what we have said is that we're not interested in sitting down with this corporation. Who we need to have at the table is the province and the federal government, not the industry.
First Nations are continuing their peaceful 135-day occupation of salmon farm facilities in the Musqueam-Naumkeag territory, the Broughton Archipelago. Marine Harvest and Cermak called the cops, took us to court, won an injunction against First Nations in their own territory. And so they're basically forcing these nations to and accept a highly damaging industry in their territory, whether they like it or not.
Last year, there were demonstrations across the province, and several First Nations groups occupied a handful of agricultural sites. There was also the release of the shocking video showing blood sweeping out of the underwater pipe into the ocean from the farmed Atlantic Salmon Processing Plant near Campbell River, British Columbia. The waste tested positive for piscine reovirus, or PRV, a virus commonly found in farmed salmon that scientists say can easily be spread to wild species, such as our wild salmon.
Last month, I published a paper in a scientific journal, PLOS One, on where wild salmon are becoming infected with the piscine reovirus. That wild salmon that are exposed to salmon farms are much more infected with the virus than salmon that are less exposed to salmon farms. And furthermore, when wild salmon get infected with this virus, they appear to have a much harder time getting up the river to spawn, which means they can't carry on the next generation. The federal government, the Trudeau government, still fighting me in court to make piscine reovirus legal for the fish farm industry to put into the ocean, because the industry said they basically can't farm without it because they're so infected. And I'm not sure why Fisheries Minister Dominique LeBlanc doesn't really get how bad this looks to work with two companies to break the laws of Canada. But anyway, that's what they're doing.
Thank you to Gennargio Sullivan for that feature. You heard the voices of Ernest Alfred and Alexander Morton. You are listening to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up, available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Now it's time for our community radio report. Gretchen King from CKUT files this feature about the ongoing crisis at CIBL, Montreal's oldest Francophone community radio station.
On January 5th, which was a Friday afternoon around 2 o'clock, I got a call from my director, and she basically told me that we were all laid off temporarily or until further notice because they didn't have the money to pay us anymore. So it was a surprise.
That's the voice of Julian, a former CIBL staff and on-air host for over 5 years. He is now out of a job, and CIBL's offices are closed. Launched in 1980, the broadcast of Montreal's oldest French community radio station continues today with a playlist of music, and no members have access to the station. Julian described the reaction of ex-staff and volunteers to the news of CIBL's closure.
Because we are all in the same group right now, ex-employees and volunteers, we are a lot of people. There was a big mobilization event 2 weeks ago, and over 150 people came up to give ideas about how to relaunch CBL. And right now, our main concern is when is that General Assembly going to be called? Because we're still waiting for the date from the board. I can say there's, not myself, but there's a lot of volunteers pressuring the board to call that General Assembly.
Julianne, do you have any message for community radio listeners or community radio stations about why community radio in general is important given what you've experienced at CIBL recently?
My message to all community radio station listeners is to be active. Don't take your media outlet for granted and stay involved mostly in the decision-making process.
Louis René has been part of CIBL since 2000. He described a debt crisis at CIBL that developed over time. He also said last year's drastic changes in programming negatively impacted volunteers like himself and did not result in improving the station's financial situation. Louis René shared his experience of changes in station governance and how he, along with other volunteers, have reacted.
The membership was really low in the last 2 years because the direction didn't want people to get involved and to get in the way of this new vision. So from this point, me and some others, and now we are 300 members since the last month that came back, into the station life. And actually, what we're doing now is to prepare the future of CIBL by forming groups outside of the station to push new ideas for the relaunch, because now there's no employees and the volunteers wants to get back to the station. The station is closed, so it's really, really strange, a really strange situation now. Yeah. So we are having some things, and we're creating committees to be able to push our view of the community radio of Montreal as it was, and in a way we see it in the future, because there's a crisis in the media, in radios in general, and for sure the financial part is really a struggling part. So what we're doing now, it's to get people involved and see what can be a more democratic life, a more community life into the radio station as it was. Because we are just trying to get back from this nightmare.
CIBL is not the only Montreal community radio station facing a nightmare. Last year, Montreal's multilingual station, Radio Centreville, kicked out community members in order to sell airtime and eliminate station debts. Jenny, a former Radio Centreville volunteer programmer, attended a recent meeting called to save CIBL.
I wanted to see if the situation at Radio Centreville and the one at CIBL were the same, so that's why I went to that meeting. So the meeting at CIBL was open to the public, so they just wanted to get everyone together and talk about the solutions for CIBL. It was really packed. There was a lot of people there. It was really amazing to see that.
As somebody who was involved at Radio Centreville before the recent move to privatize some of the activities and the airwaves of that station, and watching what's happening at CIBL, what's your take on what's happening with community radio in Montreal?
My take is that what's really being attacked, and I think the word attacked is really the one that should be used. People don't realize it, but I really feel like it's a push, an attack to against the very idea of community radio.
I asked Louis René what he has learned from the CIBL crisis.
For sure, keeping the expenses low as possible is a good first starting point. And the involvement of the community into the radio is probably the core issue. Because if you feel that your community radio is feeling well, you're listening to it, and you know, you have a schedule and you have a programming, don't feel that there's any problem. For sure, some people can get involved, taking the radio somewhere else. So the community have to stay connected to the radio, and they have to be involved into the General Assembly, be a member, get active, and be a part of it, and you know, collaborate. So that's the safest way to probably keep the community radio alive and in good health.
This is Gretchen King from CKUT in Jojage, otherwise known as Montreal, reporting for Groundwire.
Thank you to CKUT for that report. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Music this week was by Iskwe from her album The Fight Within. We thank all of our amazing community media producers for making this episode possible. Our next episode of Groundwire, releasing on Monday, February 12th, will have special coverage of the actions and vigils in memory of victims of the Quebec City massacre last January and the fight against Islamophobia across the country. If you would like to pitch a story on this theme, please email us at groundwireprod@gmail.com. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.